Okay, it's 9:30. We can get started. Boker Tov, everybody. Hope everybody is doing well. I want to dedicate today's shiur to the memory of Rav Adin Steinschultz. I'm sure many of you heard this morning that Rabbi Steinschultz, if you didn't hear, I'm sorry to pass along the sad news that Rabbi Steinschultz passed away this morning in Jerusalem, the age of 83. Rabbi Steinschultz, I'm sure most of you know, he... was an amazing figure. He translated the first complete translation of the Talmud since Rashi, basically. And he was the, you know, art scroll, everything else that Koren usually designed. So that the, he was the first one. He was the one who put this on the map, the idea that the Talmud can and should be accessible to everybody. And that was his major like project. And many schools actually use the Steinschultz Talmud. He, of course, changed the Tzurat Hadaf, what was in one page of Talmud, he put in two. And the page looked different. And for some people, that was too radical. It's also harder. They weren't used to it. And then the newer editions of the Steinschultz, he actually has both. He put back the original sort of that. But he did an amazing job. And he added in scientific, archaeological, and historical information. A lot of things in the Talmud. You know, you read about pots and pans. You don't know what it's talking about. And he has all the pictures of anybody who's seen the Steinschultz Talmud. And he wrote on many, many, many other subjects. Some phenomenal books, biblical images, Talmudic images. He wrote on Kabbalah. He wrote on Tshuva. Really a super genius. Time magazine, when they famously interviewed him, called him a person who comes around once every thousand years. And he was Adin, as his name, very soft-spoken. I mean, he was in Toronto a number of times, and I heard him speak. He was a very soft-spoken person who really accomplished an amazing amount. I always like to tell his story. I tell my kids in chat that always it comes up. He grew up in a non-observant home. His parents were not observant, Adin Steinschultz. So they asked him in this Time magazine interview a number of years ago, how did somebody growing up in a non-observant home, you know, dedicate their life to the study of Talmud and dissemination of Talmud? So he said, I think it's such a beautiful line. He says, his father said to him, says, I don't care if you become an apikoros. I don't care if you're a heretic, but no son of mine will be an Amah Aretz. I will not allow my children to be ignorant. And you want to be a heretic, but don't be ignorant. And of course, you can only be a heretic if you're not ignorant. But I think it's a beautiful line. And unfortunately, today, a problem in Judaism is not heresy, not that people reject Judaism. We people are ignorant of Judaism, and that's really our challenge. So I just want to mention really a few words. I'm sure you can read about it. That was the headlines, both in the Jerusalem Post and the Times of Israel, just when I went online. It was sort of the top story. I don't know if it still is, but his passing away. So Yehi Zichro Baruch, and okay. All right. We're at Perek Beit, Mishnah Yud Gimel. We're continuing in the teachings of the five students of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Remember this Pirkei Avot, of course, we mentioned a number of times, is sort of the historical development of our tradition, beginning Moshe Kibbutz Torah Sinai to the Anshei Knesset Agdola, and then the five pairs of Zugot, the sort of in the time of the Chashmonaim and the Greeks and the pre-Tanaitic, pre-Mishnaic period, then the six generations of the Tanaim up to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. That gets us to the year 220, and that's what Pirkei Avot, that's the first chapter and a half. And then we mentioned, we go back to Hillel, sort of the founding, you know Nasi. And then we do a Hillel student with Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, and now we're doing the five students of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. And then when we finish this, maybe today, and the third parak will begin with Akavya ben Mahalal, then we sort of leave that whole system apart. Then there's nothing to do with the historical development of our Masorah. It's just the teachings, I don't say random rabbis, but it's no longer historical development. So we're into Rabbi Shimon Amar. So 2 weeks ago, or last class, we missed last week, we talked about the importance of being careful with other people's money and to learn. Learning is not an inheritance. The Talmud says that generally the children of Torah scholars are not Torah scholars. To teach us that Torah is not an inheritance, you have to work hard. We discussed maybe in our generations, and sometimes it's a little bit different. That's not a positive thing. In other words, It's good that children also learn, but Torah is meant to be much more egalitarian and democratic. We don't want dynasties, so to speak, which is what the Gemara says. That's why children of great Torah scholars often are ignorant. We mentioned, unfortunately, talking about heresy and ignorance at the turn of the century, every great rabbinic family, almost everyone. I think the only exception, Mark Shapiro told me, the only exception was the Soloveitchik family. Rav Moshe, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, that all the kids remained observant. In every family of the greatest of the great Torah scholars, they had children who became non-observant. That was the way of the world. Okay, let's continue. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Havi Zahir B'Kriyat Shema U'Betfila. So now he's going to go back to the ritual side. Be careful when you are in Kriyat Shema, which of course last week we read Vatchana, the first paragraph of Shema. And tomorrow we'll read the second paragraph of Shema. And on Sunday, Jonathan Ziering will be starting a three-part series on Kriyat Shema, 11 a.m., just the next three Sundays, just to put in a little plug. He's wonderful. Be careful in the saying of Shema and Tefillah. So first, why? Okay, Shata Mitpalel, and when you pray, Al Tas Tefillatcha Keva. Don't make your prayer permanent. Ela rachamim v'tachlunim, it should be mercy and pleading mitnei hamakom baruch hu, before the blessed one, hamakom baruch hu. So first of all, the first thing, if you have to tell somebody to be careful about something, that means because they're not so careful. In other words, you only warn. It's an interesting heavy zahir. In other words, normally says do this, do that. Heavy zahir has a language of be very concerned, be very cautious, because the prayer is very hard. Shema is very hard. Now, when somebody says, be careful in Shema, he doesn't just mean to say the word Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. It means the concept of the acceptance of the yoke of heaven. Shema is, you know, we accept the yoke of heaven. The truth of the matter, a lot of people find this, are not aware of this, but in the Talmud itself, there's a debate whether we have to say Shema every day. We are so used to it that that's our basic, affirmation of our faith. When we go to bed, when we wake up, it's morning and evening, and then we say it in Kiddushah, and we say Kriyat Shema Lamita, and we have to say Shema. But according to some opinions in the Talmud, the idea that v'shinantel v'necha, v'shivtecha v'itecha, l'atecha v'derach, v'shofecha u'kumecha, and you hear it, it's talking about the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. You should teach your children and speak in the words of Torah. When you're home, when you get up and you go to bed. So the Talmud says, you don't have to say Shema. You have to learn. You have to learn every day. It's a rabbinic obligation to say Shema. I think we generally accept it being that it's a biblical obligation to say Shema. But that's an interesting thing, that whether the Shema itself is actually biblical obligation is a debate. Nonetheless, of course, I sing. It's not the saying of Shema. It's the acceptance of the yoke of heaven. That's hard. That's very hard. We spoke a few weeks ago where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai himself told his students on his deathbed, if you should fear God as much as you fear man. And the students were disappointed. I don't need Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to tell me that. And of course, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, yes, you do. Halavai, if only you can do that. So that's the first thing. We all know, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but speaking for myself, prayer is extremely hard. It's Rabbi Gemara here in Toronto, you called it, maybe it's not a nice term, but he said the Vietnam of the of our day schools. In other words, it's very difficult. It's three times a day, it's boring, it's the same words, and where we don't even know why we say it. Well, we say it, it's very hard. How are you? Motivated. You know what? I'm sorry.
Any update on?
Okay. You can still hear me, everybody? Okay, thank you. So anyways, prayer is a very difficult mitzvah. We all know it. And the truth of the matter is prayer, the way we pray is not the way it's supposed to be. Prayer is supposed to be spontaneous. When the Mishnah says, don't make your prayer permanent, what does that mean? It means don't say the same words every single day. Don't have a fixed schedule. You know, it takes 8 minutes for Psukei Dezimra or whatever. It depends what shul you have in it. You know, and 14 minutes, you know, the minyan's got to finish in 20 minutes. And there are lots of minyanim like that. You know, the early minyan, people, they daven at 6:30, got to be finished before 7 because people have to go to work. So there's something very beautiful about that, that people take the time out. That's the famous story. You know, the guy is putting oil on his wheels, on his wagon, you know, for the horse and the buggy. And he's davening. He's putting on his tefillin. He has his tefillin on and he's davening, putting on. And the guy says, hey, How terrible, you know, can't he concentrate on founding of Rav Levi Yitzchak Berdichev says, what an amazing Jew, even when he oils his wheels, he davens. So it depends how you look at it. But davening was not meant, we've discussed this, davening was meant to be spontaneous from the heart. The Rambam says you daven once a day, whenever you want, whatever you want, however you want, doesn't really matter. You have to say a little bit of praise, you have to ask God for something, give thanksgiving. Shevach Bakashah Hodah, the three parts of the Shemone Esrei. But what you say and how and when doesn't matter. But the problem is that doesn't work on a communal level. People wouldn't know what to say. It can't work communally. But so in a funny way, the fact that we have a Sidur, which means a Seder in order, it makes prayer more difficult, which is why the sages maintained the Shemone Esrei as silent. In other words, of course, everything we do up to Shemone Esrei is not really prayer. When the Talmud talks about prayer, it means only Shemone Esrei. Shema is not a prayer. Shema is the acceptance of the yoke of heaven. Psukei Dezimra is not a prayer. It's praises of God. The Birchot Kriyashma is not a prayer. It's talking about God's great mastery of nature, Hameir La'aretz. You know, he created the earth and the heavens. And the second bracha, Ahava Rabbah, is the beauty of Torah. God gave us the Torah. Prayer is only Shemone Esrei. And the rabbis insisted that Shemone Esrei be said silently, so people can really add in their own things. The Shemone Esrei is a guide, health and wealth and wisdom, so we can add in our own personal prayers. And then the chazan repeats it initially because people didn't know how to daven. People didn't have a siddur, there weren't any printing presses. The first siddur only makes its appearance in the 8th or 9th century, the first time we ever have a siddur. Rav David Silver, said people used to go to shul in Yerushalayim or in Bavel. They didn't know what they would daven. All the pew team, you know, many of which we skip, but the pew team, beautiful pew team, a lot of them were composed. And we know we have them, Parshat Shkalim, we have before Purim, before Pesach, certain liturgical poems for special occasions. So the Paitan would compose a pew for this week. So it's Parshat Ekev. And he comes to shul, and the poet, the Arshaliach Zibur, our cousin, would compose a prayer. People didn't have a sin. He would say it, and it would be a new prayer every week. Prayer was very different. It wasn't the way we have it today, but we don't have much of a choice of that. But as it is, we have to remember prayer is avodah shebelev. It's worship of the heart, and it has to stay in the heart. It's not saying words. Saying words are the mechanics of prayer, but prayer is the heart, and we know, and that's hard. But like everything, you know, you have to practice a lot and then hopefully you get inspired. Like I say, hopefully Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur at least. I find prayer moving and meaningful and inspiring. Once in a while, you find it inspiring. Yeah, if you never go to shul, you're not going to find prayer inspiring on Rosh Hashanah. You go every day and you're bored half the time, but you have a chance of perhaps finding it inspiring. So you have to be very careful. You have to work at it. Kriyat Shema and Tefillah, which I said are not the same thing. Kriyat Shema is a statement of faith, the acceptance of God's Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim, the acceptance of the yoke of heaven, accepting mitzvot, reward and punishment, etc. And Tefillah is asking for our needs. And of course, in a certain sense, thank God, prayer is hard. We should be thankful. Even today, I mean, it's, you know, when is prayer easy? When life is difficult, prayer is easy. When there's an explosion and there's a pandemic, people find it a little easier to pray because they're nervous, they're worried. So we should be thankful that we find prayer hard, because prayer, as the Ramban mentions famously, is stems only. You only have to pray in a time of need, right? The Rambam says you have to pray every day. Avodah shebelev, avadata Hashem b'chol levavchem, worship God with your heart. That's prayer. And the Ramban says no. It's a pasuk in Balotcha, when the enemy comes, you blow the shofar, meaning you pray. Shofar is Rav Soloveitchik famously said, shofar is prayer without words, because words are limiting. We never know what to say. We can never express ourselves so well. That's why poetry is better than prose, because it's not the words, it's behind the words. So the shofar, and that's why we blow shofar in the middle of the Shemone Esrei. We don't shake the lulav in the middle of the Shemone Esrei, because what does lulav have to do with prayer? But we blow the shofar. Shofar is our prayer without words. So, but prayer emanates only when there's a sense of need, the Ramban says. When the enemy comes, you blow the shofar and you have to pray. So the Ramban says, if you don't have any needs, you don't have to pray. When you do have needs, then you have to pray with the minyan, because it says in the Torah there in Parsha Palocha, you should bahakel etam, you gather the people together and blow the shofar. So the Ramban says normally you don't have to pray, but God forbid there are problems in the world, you have to pray. And not only have to pray, you have to pray with a minyan, because we come together as a community. That's how we solve problems. When time of need, you can't do it on your own. So the Ramban says you have to pray with the minyan biblically, but that's on rare occasions. Rav Soloveitchik got his famous idea that they're not arguing. Even the Rambam agrees that prayer is only in a sense of and a time of need, but man is always in a perpetual state of need. It's such a beautiful idea, such a the philosophical, you know, approach of Rav Soloveitchik, that both the Rambam and the Ramban agree that we only pray out of a sense of need. But the Rambam just feels man has needs every day. And if you don't realize it, it's a pity. Like the snake, the curse of the snake is that the food has to eat from the earth, the dust of the earth. What kind of a curse? That's great. It doesn't have to work for his food. It's there all the time. But that's the idea. If you don't have any needs, that's not human existence. A human person without needs, that's not a human being. So anyways, that's a little bit. And I'll add what I've also mentioned before, but it's beautiful. And if we can follow this Ramban, the same Ramban who says that prayer only emanates instead of need, says that prayer is a gift of God. I mentioned normally prayer is not an obligation, the Ramban says. Normally it's not. Rather, it's a gift. God allows us to pray. And I say, well, what right do we have to approach God and ask him for things? A chutzpah three times a day. We are nudniks. You know, you go ask somebody for something three times a day, get out of here already. I heard you yesterday, today, the same thing. And you're not even paying attention when you pray to me, maybe. You know, you're on your phone a little bit and who knows what, and your mind is wandering. A nudnik, this. So the Ramban says prayer is a tremendous act of kindness of God, that God allows us to pray. So that's a beautiful idea the Ramban expresses when he critiques the Rambam. In the Rambam, when he lists the 613 mitzvot, so the fifth mitzvah, I believe, Rambam lists this prayer. The first mitzvah is belief in God, and then to love God, to fear God. I think it's the fifth mitzvah the Rambam writes is the mitzvah of prayer. And the Ramban says it's not a mitzvah. There is no biblical mitzvah generally to pray. It's an act of kindness. Okay. Anyways, that's a little bit, but prayer has to be from the emotion, from the heart, and it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to do, and of course, we all recognize that. Okay. That's why Rav Shimon says, try to be careful. Okay, and they quote the Pasuk El Rachamim, it's mercy before God. And then the Mishnah continues, quotes the Pasuk Kichanun Brachum, who God is full of mercy and kindness. Erech Apayim, patience, is a little bit from Sefer Yoel. Those who were at the talk yesterday by Yaakov Kabizli on Atreyasar, so he spoke about how the theme of the Yud Gimel Midot, which is, he spoke on the theme of Tshuva. That's what unites all 12 books in Atreyasar. Tshuva, and then he's, and of course, Tshuva, the Yud Gimel Midot is what we say, the 13 attributes of mercy. That's what we say over and over again on Yom Kippur. So we have variations of that in Micha, and here you have in Yoel, the book of Yoel, quoting, it sounds, it's not exactly the Yud Gimel Midot, but it's very similar. Tichanun Brachum Hu, Erech Apayim, God is patient, Rav Chesed, and it doesn't say Ve'emet, he spoke about that, full of kindness, V'nicham Al Hara, and God is, he is sorry for the evil. Now, what does that have to do with prayer? In other words, he quotes the verse from Yoel, okay, the Chanun Rachum, we understand. Nicham al Hara, and God, he changes himself, like we had by Noach. He was going to destroy the world. Vayinachem Hashem, and then Noach found favor. But here it means, Nicham al Hara, he goes back. If you pray, the idea of prayer, we believe, is that you can change God. You can change God's plan. I mean, there's a whole debate in the Gemara. I wrote about a few years ago in, you know, what does it mean that, we're not going to get into this now, but I'll just raise the issue. You know, Barosh Hashanah, how does it intend to go? Barosh Hashanah, Yichatevu, Yom Som Kippur, Yichatevu. On Rosh Hashanah, it's written. On Yom Kippur, it's sealed, right? So what does that mean? So what happens on Yud Aleph Tishrei? Okay, you're a Kabbalist, so it's not sealed till Hoshana Rabbah. Okay, great. So what happens after Hoshana Rabbah? When we pray in August, what are we praying for? For only next year? Because last year sealed? Very difficult. Well, it's a whole discussion about it. Not so simple. And what may be only individual prayer sealed, not communal prayer. But the whole mechanism is, what are we trying to accomplish by prayer? Are we trying to change God? Are we trying to change ourselves? Are we trying to make ourselves aware of our issues? It's very, very complicated. And it's we have to study this a little bit more. But that's just, the idea that prayer can change God. I mean, obviously, that's, we believe that. The question is when, how, and what mechanism is not so simple. And often, obviously, it doesn't work that way. And Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who taught. It was through Moshe's prayer that he saved us for this, from the sin of the golden calf. Moshe prayer did influence God. We know sometimes you're not allowed to pray. The Gemara says that the famous story of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who was very sick, and all his students were praying that he should get better, but he was in pain. And the maidservant, the non-Jewish maidservant, saw this, said, "This is ridiculous." And she took a heavy plate thing and she banged it on the floor, and everybody, you know, was all startled, and they stopped praying for 5 seconds. You know, well, what is this? And during the 5 seconds, he died. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. That's how the Gemara presents the story. Doesn't have to, don't have to take it literally. And the Mefarshim say that the maidservant was right. That's the idea, that that's because a lot of this Gemara is used very often in discussions on end of life issues. But there is an idea that the poskim bring, the halachic authorities do say there are times you're actually allowed to pray for somebody to die. You can't kill them. That we cannot do. That's up to God. But to pray that somebody who's in pain or suffering should die, that sometimes is appropriate. We don't always pray. Anyways, that's there's a lot to discuss about prayer. Then the Mishnah continues, and Balti Rasha b'pnei atzmecha. Do not be evil in your own eyes. What does that mean? Do not be a Rasha b'pnei atzmecha. So the Rambam explains, don't view yourself as a Rasha. We know that if a person thinks lowly of himself, he's not going to accomplish much. In other words, you have to, we're great people, you know, Judaism has that ability sometimes, you know, especially you learn Pirkei Avot, you know, you're doing this wrong and that wrong. Yeah, we don't pray properly. Yeah, that's fine. But our rabbis knew that. So sometimes there's a feeling we're worthless, like it's all hopeless. So the rabbis have to say, no. It's normal. God doesn't expect us to daven with kavanah three times a day. It's not realistic. We have to go through the motions occasionally, and occasionally we'll daven. There's a realism. Our sages are very, very realistic. And so don't view yourself as evil. We do great things and we're great people. We have great potential. Can we do better? Sure, we can do better, but that shouldn't let us get us down. Al tei rasha b'pnei atzmecha. Don't give up on yourself. They have the famous story, you know, of the Chafetz Chaim. They have all these stories of the Chafetz. You know, this story, of course, I only heard told in the name of the Chafetz Chaim. But, you know, when you get these stories that they tell it about 10 different rabbis, so, you know, it's okay. The stories are not meant to be truthful. The stories are meant to address a point. Although some of them, it's like Berowine famously said, anybody who believes all these stories they say about rabbis is an idiot. And anybody who doesn't believe any of them is a heretic. Okay. So I prefer to be a heretic than an idiot, but that probably is worse to be an idiot. But anyway, so we have to take it with a little bit. But here with the Chafetz Chaim, knowing what we know about the Chafetz Chaim, the story makes a lot of sense. That they tell the story, you know, the Chafetz Chaim's on a train. He's always on a train, I guess. So the Chafetz Chaim's on a train, and somebody, they don't recognize people, you know. So they have the story, somebody is praising the Chafetz Chaim. He's saying, you know, where are you going? They're going to Radin, where he lives. So Radin, oh, the great Chafetz Chaim lives there. So the Chafetz Chaim, who he's talking to, but he doesn't know that he's not so great. You know, I know him. And he's going on and on and on, and, you know, terrible, and he's saying how great, and he really gets mad at the question whether it hits him or not. And of course, then he gets to the city and he finds out it's the Chafetz Chaim, and he feels terrible. And the Chafetz Chaim says, No, you were right. You taught me an important lesson. I wrote a whole book on the laws of libel and slander of Lashon Hara, and I forgot to mention you can't talk Lashon Hara on yourself either. You're not allowed to talk Lashon Hara on yourself. It's not only to talk Lashon Hara about other people, it's a beautiful idea. So al tei rasha b'pnei atzmecha. On that, I'll say something kind of interesting. We know the Musar movement started by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. I mean, it's always hard. You're teaching a group of people. I'm not sure what people know, how much people know about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter or not. But 19th century. So the founder, we called another the Musar movement. He realized that Jews were focused like today. observant Jews and non-observant Jews of other issues. But in the observant world, the problem is we're focused too much on ritual and not enough on ethics. We all know that. We have to daven three times a day, but the ethics behind it, like what the prophets say, I don't need your sacrifices. I want you to treat the poor well. So this has been an ongoing problem. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the problem got worse or whatever, he wanted to do something about it. And he found it, you know, Musar yeshivas, people should study ethical works. And it was quite controversial. Rav Chaim Brisker, for example, was very much opposed to it. He said, it's a waste of time. Only people who are sick need it. And we you don't need it. And whatever, the whole debate, fine. The Musar move. But the two famous, you know, Musar yeshivas, maybe people have heard this. Even so, I hope it's worth retelling. And the two most famous yeshivas in the Musar world were the yeshivas in Slobodka, which later, the Hebron Yeshiva, the Slobodka Yeshiva was the yeshiva that moved to Hebron in 1922, and they were the ones who were massacred in the 1929 riots. And the Yeshiva of Nevardik, which Gateshead, Irene, I know you're on from Gateshead. So Gateshead was a branch at the time started of Nevardik Yeshiva. The Slobodka Yeshiva, great, great people, very famous. I'll just mention if you... Tzvi Pesach Frank, the chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Aaron Cutler, Harry Wilson from Harvard University. I mean, the Sri Leish, Yaakov Weinberg, all these yeshivas, by the way, had people who became great in many other areas. And many of them became non-observant later on in life. They that was an era, as we were discussing earlier. Nevardik, the Stipler learned in Nevardik. In America, learned in Nevardik. Yitz Greenberg is a graduate of the Nevardik branch in America. Whatever. So what was the famous difference between yeshivas and Slobodka and Nevardik? In Slobodka, they taught about the greatness of man. Man is great. And you had to dress impeccably, and you had to, dignified, and wow, we're Bnei Torah. We're carrying on a 4,000-year-old tradition. We're creating the image of God. Man is an amazing, amazing person. We saw how great we are. And in Nevardik, it was the exact opposite. You're a nobody. You know, those are all the old jokes. Who is he to be? You have to be a somebody to be a nobody. But in Nevardik, the idea was to break your ego, to put you down, that man is so lowly, we're no better than the ants, we're going to end up in the grave, you know, to lower that. And it's clear, I think, anybody alive today, the Nevardik approach, even back then, the Nevardik approach is not from us. It's we need a Slobodka approach. Man is great, and we can do better, but man is wonderful. And to talk about the greatness, and especially those who are in education, if you're dealing with you know, teenagers, maybe it worked at some time, but it sure doesn't work today to tell people how terrible they are. It just doesn't work. And anyway, so that's Alte Rasha Bifnei Atzmecha. By the way, the Bartanura fascinatingly said, do not be evil. What does that mean? Do not separate from our community. Because you want to do good, you need to be part of a community. Good, just like evil doesn't exist in a vacuum, good doesn't exist in a vacuum. And the way to improve yourself is to join a community of like-minded people who want to improve the world. So when that's, he doesn't say the way we view ourselves, he puts it into action. Alte Rasha, Bifnei Atzmecha, means do not separate yourself from our community. Okay, that's Mishnah Yud Gimel. Let's go to Mishnah Yud Dalit. Rabbi Elazar Amir. Remember, these are the five students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We're now at the fifth of the five students, each one of the five students giving their teaching. So this is Rav Elazar ben Arach, who, according to one opinion, outweighed all the other rabbis. You put him on one side of the scale and the rest of the world on the other side. Rav Elazar ben Arach, he was the Mayan HaMitgaber. He was a overflowing well, always new insights, new ideas, always, an overflowing well that never ceases to give fresh water. So Rav Elazar says, "Hevi shakud lomo Torah." The word shakud, I checked in three sidurim how they would translate. They all translate diligent. Be diligent in the study of Torah. We'll get to that in a second. Dam alahashiv lapikoros, talking about know how to refute. Know how to answer lapikoros. V'dalif nei miyata amela, know before whom you work. The Nemanu Bamalachtecha, and the boss, this God, the boss here in charge of the work, He's faithful. He's going to pay you. You're working for the boss upstairs, and he's going to pay you. So let's take this apart a little bit. Okay. First thing is heavy shakud limot Torah. So the connection. You have to learn Torah well enough that you know how to answer an apikoros. In other words, we have to be able to defend Torah. So it's very fat. You have to defend Torah, and you have to know, well, how do you do that? So it's very interesting. The Tiferet Yisrael, in his commentary, 19th century, we quote him a lot, says, I'll just say, he has three ideas. What do I mean? Be diligent in learning of Torah. So he says, number one, the most important thing is review. And you know, it's very hard to say that. People really don't like that, but it's so true. The most important part of learning is review. And I just looked up last night, you know, I know the numbers, the, you know, how our brain works. And without review, the what they say is within 1 hour, meaning at 11:30 this morning, I shouldn't say that, but at 11:30 this morning, within 1 hour, people forget approximately 50% of what they just learned. 1 hour. Within 24 hours, about 70%. And within a week, 90%. Okay, that's not bad. A week later, you remember 10% of what you learned. So, and the only way to stop, this is in science, you know, whether it's 86% or 91%, but all the numbers are pretty much the same. Unless you review, you have to review. But people don't like to review. People always like to have fresh and new things. And, you know, so it's good speaker, whatever. You have to come back to similar things. And it's okay to say the same things over. And our rabbis say, it's not the same thing to review 100 times or 101 times. It's a beautiful expression. Matter of fact, in the copy of the Mishnah, I love to use in the Mishnah Stura that they have, you know, that has the Mishnah so beautifully aligned, not really with commentary, but the sentence structure broken up and bold and interesting. So that's what they have at the beginning. They have a whole chart here. You have to list off, you have to mark off the 101 times you reviewed the Mishnah. And it says, what the difference between a tzaddik, an Oved Elohim, and a tzaddik. And the Gemara says they're both like tzaddikim, but you cannot compare somebody who reviews something 100 times to somebody who reviews something 101 times. Now that's pretty wild. But that's to review some. So our sages knew how important review was. They say, I don't know if this is, I don't believe this, but it's a cute thing to say that, you know, when you open up a page of Gemara, so this I'm sure, I don't know why the printers actually did it like this, but that's how it is in every single page of Gemara. Rashi, the first four lines are wide and then it gets narrow, right? You look like a top of page, it's like a sort of, it's broader at the top and then Rashi gets narrow. And sometimes it gets thick again, wide again at the bottom, but always the first four lines of Rashi at the top of the page are always wide. So say you have to review a minimum of four times before you get to the Gemara. So that's the first challenge that people have is to review. Like I say, people find that hard and they don't like to do it, but that's why testing is so important, et cetera, et cetera. That's the number one thing in learning. Number two, and this gets to more how to answer that because he says, that's what I mean, shaked, be shakud, be very diligent in learning over and over again till you know it backwards and forwards. And we know that. Rav Soloveitchik actually would very often teach the same masechet 2 years in a row. It's an amazing thing. Can you imagine going to yeshiva and learn Bava Kama 1 year and the next year Bava Kama? And it's there. I mean, I heard it from people who were in Hashir that Rav Soloveitchik would say something in the second year and somebody would put up his hand and said, but Rebbe, you said something different last year. You explained differently. And the Rav would get upset. What are you talking about? Who cares what they did last year? We learn it again. Every time the Rav, and I think it was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein when they wrote to you after the Rav like passed away and they had all the eulogies, all the articles. I think it was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, but it may have been somebody else. It really doesn't matter. Who wrote that the greatness of the Rav, he said, which really no other Rosh Yeshiva did. Most Rosh Yeshivas are, unfortunately, have to be fundraisers. This says most people, they don't have energy. They do their learning. By the time they're 20, they know Shas backwards and forwards. These are brilliant people. They know things. And 20, 30 years old. And after 30, they barely learn. They review. They say the same insights over again. It's very hard. He says, Rav Soloveitchik, every single time you learn, it's as if he was learning it for the first time in his life. With the review was not just a review, it was to learn it again from start. That's even harder. But even if you just review your notes, but that's heavy shakud. Now, dama lashiv lapikoris. So he says, when you learn, you have to ask the right question. So he says, when you learn, you have to ask, you have to ask who, what, for whom, when, how, and why. Every time you learn something, you have to learn what is it, who's saying it, who's he saying it to, when, how, why. Why, it's like, in a, you know, everything you learn, and until you can answer all those questions, you can't go on. And that's the way you'll be able to answer any skeptics. In other words, it's not enough to know. Everybody knows, you know, you ask somebody, did you understand that? They say yes. And then you say, can you say it over? Oh, no, I can't really explain it, but I understand. So we all know, all the adults know, that if you can't explain it, you don't understand it. You may understand a little bit, but if you can't say it over, you haven't learned it. That's why it's so important that, you know, and again, in Yeshiva, kids have to give, you know, presentations of what they learn. That's the way you get to learn. But you always have to ask questions. So that's Dama Lashiv Lapikoris. And we have to engage the Apikoris, right? Often the questions of the Apikoris are good questions. Like we started the beginning with Adin Steinschild. It's okay to be an Apikoris. It's being an Amaretz, that is the real problem. But very often the apikorsim are because nobody answered their questions, and that's what the Tiferet Yisrael. By the way, I don't know how much he was influenced. He lived in the middle of the 1800s. So then that was the beginning where Jews were leaving religion in droves. But so you have to ask the right question. You can't have your hands inside. The Maritz Chayitz, also living in the 1800s, printed in the back of the Gemara, but Zvi Hirsch Chayitz, or in English, I think they pronounce it, you know, Chayes, Chayes. They've translated some of his works into English. So he has a whole attack, on the Reform movement, the whole discussion of the Reform movement. Then he says a lot of it is the rabbis were asleep at the wheel. In other words, they didn't know how to respond to the questions of the day. And so people left observance. Okay. So it's very important that we don't, you know, when people just belittle, people are non-observant or they're wrong. First of all, it's wrong. It's just the wrong thing to do. But B, it's not effective at all. Often these people are yearning. You know, our issue is not Jews who observe Judaism with different interpretations than we do. Our issue is Jews who don't observe Judaism. If they halavai, somebody goes, as Rav Lichtenstein said, halavai, somebody in Albuquerque drives the shul on Rosh Hashanah. We want them to stay at home and watch television. Baruch Hashem, there are Jews who drive the shul just on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, go to a Reform shul. That's a lot better than many of the alternatives. Anyway, so yeah, you have to know how to answer. You have to engage people in discussion. And sometimes if you engage them, and if we believe, you know, I believe, as I believe, Torah is intellectually, you know, it makes sense. You can make a moral, ethical, intellectual argument for it. So there are issues, there are challenges, and we often can't deal with all the issues. You know, how do we deal with LGBT rights and things like that? These are challenging issues or aguna issues. We haven't solved all the problems, but you have to believe that what you're doing is that I don't do it because my grandparents and my parents did. I do it because I think it's right. That's way of judging, because it's a beautiful way of life. So if we can express that, we can know how to answer the skeptics, show them all the beauty of Judaism, show we're not afraid of the issues. We don't run away from the issues. We address them head on. And you're right, sometimes their answers don't always work. Okay, Beseder, so we try more. But that's what it means, Da Malahashi Vapi Chorus. We're not belittling them. We're engaging them and trying to constructively move forward. And says the third thing is to focus. You know, if you want to learn, you can't be on your cell phone at the same time. And that's Dalif Neimi. What's the third thing in the Mishnah? Dalif Neimi Atamel. Know before who you're working. In other words, you're working for God. You don't like on the side, you know, look in the newspaper. We all have that. Everybody knows, all the research is people cannot multitask. Multitasking does not work. Everybody thinks they can do it, but nobody can do it well. If you want to really do something, you have 100% focus. And we all know that the people who are very successful are driven, and you see the focus that they have, the way they can totally block out things. I mean, the famous story with Rav Amital, I mean, I'm maybe saying sort of the opposite here, but the idea, you know, Rav Yehuda Amital, the founding Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshivat Har Etzion, who then invited Rav Lichtenstein to join. So the very well-known story, anybody who learned in Har Etzion or from that world knows when they asked Rav Amital, what's the guiding philosophy of the yeshiva? So he told the story of one of the early, the Lubavitcher Rebbe's, one of the first ones, I think the third one, I'm not sure, on the Tzemach Tzedek, I think, but he was learning Torah with his grandson, with his son or his grandson were up learning Torah. And it was late at night. And the baby sleeping upstairs began to cry. So the grandfather, Tzemach Tzedek, went to hear the cries, went to deal with the child, the baby who was crying. And the grandson was so immersed in learning Torah, he didn't hear the child crying. He was so focused on Torah, he didn't hear. So Rav Amital, of course, was very critical. So he said, learning Torah, when you don't hear the cries of others, when you learn Torah, that's not learning Torah. When you learn Torah, you have to hear the cries of the outsiders. You have to, we're not just in the yeshiva, we're here to make an impact on society. We have to hear the cries of other people. So it's a beautiful story. It's a well-known story, and that's what Rav Amital said. That's the philosophy of Yeshivat Har Etzion. Okay, I just want to spend a couple minutes on this term apikoros a little bit. What is an apikoros? Again, I'm not going to go whole philosophy class, all the definitions, but exactly what is it? We use the term very, very loosely. You know, anybody, yeah, he's an apikoros. You know, if you think the world is more than 6,000 years, he's an apikoros. Everybody's an apikoros who says something you don't like. But what exactly, is exactly an apikoros? So, as far as I know, the first time or the only time the term apikoros appears in Talmudic literature is in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, the famous Mishnah which says that we use the first half to introduce Pirkei Avot. Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelech olam haba. The whole world has a share in the world to come. Ve'amech kulam tzadikim, right? We're all righteous. That's how we said. Yeah, don't see yourself as evil. Amech kulam tzadikim. We're all righteous. We're all wonderful people. Yeah, we make mistakes. That's okay. Remember, the Rambam in Hilchot Tshuva defines a tzadik as one who is 50% plus one mitzvot. Ain't tzadik bar tzeshel lo yechta. There's no such thing as a person who doesn't sin. Impossible. And to be a tzadik, you just have to be 50% plus one. That's how the Rambam defines it in Hilchot Tshuva. Avama kulam tzaddik, and we're all great. At the same time, there are people who are evil. Not everybody. Sometimes people are not that 50% plus one. And so the Mishnah lists people who lose their share in the world to come. So one of the people who loses their share in the world to come is an apikoros. So and Rashi there says, Begmara mefarish lehu. It's a very funny, interesting comment. You know, Rashi, why does Rashi say that? Rashi, it's like sometimes you're going to learn the Mishnah, you're going to come across a term. Rashi explains things that are hard to understand. And when people are learning it, they're not going to know what it means. So that's what Rashi's there for, to explain to you what the words of the Gemara mean. So it comes to apikoros, so you don't know what it means. Well, what's an apikoros? I mean, we use the term loosely, but a real like Torah scholar, he's learning Torah. He doesn't know what's an apikoros. I never heard of the term. It's a Greek term, as we'll see, right? It's never heard of it. So Rashi, instead of explaining it, sometimes he said, don't worry about it. When you get to the Gemara, like 10 pages later, it's about 10 pages after the Mishnah. I mean, and Rashi didn't have a printed Talmud, of course, but he says, but Gemara mefarshtu. The Gemara will explain what an apikoros is. So the Gemara, how does the Gemara explain an apikoros? So the Gemara has a little bit of a debate. So the Gemara says an apikoros is one who belittles the Torah scholar. He makes fun of Torah, or he makes fun of people who represent Torah. He belittles Torah scholars. Fascinating. And then the Gemara quotes a second thing. No, not that he belittles Torah scholars. He belittles his friend in front of a Torah scholar. In other words, you belittle anybody. No, you belittle somebody in your backyard, just you and him and nobody hears. Okay, so he's upset at you, but it doesn't really have impact. But if I belittle somebody in front of the Queen of England, in front of an important person, from a Torah scholar, that's very insulting, very embarrassing. That makes you an apikoros. It doesn't matter how religious, it has nothing to do with our religious beliefs. It has to do with how we treat other people, either how we treat scholars or how we treat simple people. It's beautiful. That's how the Gemara defines an apikoros. The Bartanura on our Mishnah, the most classic commentary, says, Rav Avadim Bartanura, says it means a Torah's hefker. In other words, he gives it more of a religious thing. He belittles Torah. Torah is not important. Who cares what it says in the Torah? The Rambam interesting. The Rambam, who of course is the most theological of all, you know, our commentators, the Rambam who introduced the notion that theology is the simple reading of the Rambam is theology is more important than observance of mitzvot. He's the one who gave theology in the 13 principles of faith, a lot of discussion about that. You know, but he was the one who put it front and center. We normally believe Judaism is much more interested in what you do than what you believe. And it's still true. And I even think the Rambam believed it was true. But the Rambam, nonetheless, was the one who put faith as very crucial, especially in our relationship to how we get to the world to come. Because the Rambam saw the world to come as an intellectual reward. It's for the intellects, the philosophers. So the Rambam says one whose philosophy is improper can't come to the world to come. It's like if you don't pass biology and organic chemistry, you can't get into medical school. It's not a punishment not to get into medical school, just you're not qualified. So that's how the Rambam saw the world to come. It's not a reward for our good deeds. It's a place of intellectual achievement. And if you don't have that intellectual achievement, if you don't have that proper understanding of God as he defines through the 13 attributes, you can't reach the world to come. And this is an important debate, an important discussion, not really for now, but just to be aware. That's the Rambam. So the Rambam in Hilchot Tshuva, where he discusses this, very close to where he says a tzaddik is one who's 50% plus one. So the Rambam defines an apikoros as a person who, A, doesn't believe in prophecy, the notion that God has spoken to human beings. He contradicts the prophecy of Moshe. Remember, one of the principles of faith of the Rambam is that Moshe is the greatest prophet, not just that believe in prophecy, Moshe is the greatest prophet. And number three, he says God does not know our actions. An apikoros means that God is not really, doesn't know what we're doing. Now, I think I've never seen this. I haven't studied this. I don't know. I thought I muted everybody, but I get my off there. Can mute yourself, please. Okay. I don't know what happened here. Anyway, I think, although I haven't seen this, that probably Epicurus comes from Epicurus, like the Greek philosopher, 4th century BCE. I'm sure when the and that's why, you know, what's an Epicurus? Somebody follows the philosophy of Epicurus. And obviously at the time, people knew what that was. Later time, people didn't know Greek philosophy necessarily. Now, who was Epicurus? So he taught, I would say I read the Wikipedia article. I can admit that. I'm going to mute everybody again. I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. Okay. You can hear me? Just nod. You can hear me good. Okay. Thank you very much. So one thing he believed, this may be not nothing wrong with this, although it's interesting, it depends how much emphasis, the purpose of life is happiness. So he do it the Shem is simple. That's not so much of a problem, although it depends how far you take that. But the two key beliefs that he believed, which would quote unquote make him an apikoros, which make the rabbis use his name as the sort of the Rambam, is, you know, someone the one who denies the basics of Judaism, even though I said originally in the Talmud, it's how we act towards others, but later on it gets this belief in our thought process, is death is the end of the soul and the body. Traditional belief, of course, is death is the end of the body, but not the end of the soul. The soul lives on. And number two, the gods have no role in human affairs. God created the world, but have nothing to do. He also believes the world's eternal. But that was a common Greek belief. And the Rambam himself says, if he was convinced that the world was eternal, he would reinterpret Bereshit Bara Elohim. That's a famous Rambam. And the guy writes that, you know, he was a great rationalist, the Rambam. And if he believed that the world was eternal, it says God created the world. No, so he can interpret the a metaphor. We don't interpret the Torah literally. He happened not to believe that rationally. He didn't believe the world was eternal, so he had no reason to reinterpret Bereshit, but he would have been willing to do something like that. But anyways, that's but the idea that God has no role in human affairs and the end of the body and soul, so he became the symbol of what it means to be a non-believer. Okay, that's a little bit to what an apikoros is. We have to answer apikoros. We have to engage. We have to know our Torah so well. Why? What? I like as the Tiferet Yisrael say, not just how and what and when and where, but why. There were some who opposed that whole endeavor, but the thrust of Jewish tradition is that it's very important to know why we do mitzvot, even though the Torah doesn't tell us. We have to find reason. And I think one of the reasons the Torah doesn't tell us is because everybody has their own personal reasons. In other words, and in different generations, different mitzvot take on different meanings. We discussed, I don't know if I discussed in the Pirkei Avot here. If I did, you can interrupt me, write me a note, whatever. But the famous comment of the Meshra Chochma, Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk, who passed away in 1926, that in every historical time period, different mitzvot take on greater importance. In other words, in every history, when are you living? So I mentioned Rav Schachter said, in our generation, the important mitzvah is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. There was a mitzvah to live in Israel in 1200s also, but so you live in Israel in 1200, big deal. Today, living in Israel, we're creating a whole society. It's a whole different thing. So every generation has their own mitzvah. He explains, and every generation can find new meaning in mitzvot. I think that's really one of the reasons the Torah doesn't give meaning. We have to find our own meaning. And throughout history, great rabbis have written the Sefer Chinuch being the most famous, but not the only book, on Tamei HaMitzvot. And it's okay to find your own reason for all the mitzvot of the Torah. So we have to know why. Why do we observe Judaism? It's not enough to observe it. And I think today, sometimes in certain circles and the traditional community, there's overemphasis on what we do as opposed to why we're doing what we do. And sometimes questions are not always encouraged, unfortunately. I told my kids to answer the phone, but okay. Anyways, all right. Okay, let's finish up the parak. We have a few minutes left. The last Mishnah, Rabbi Tarfon Omer. So I was wondering, and thank God I saw the Melechet Shlomo asked the question, what is Rabbi Tarfon doing here? The last Mishnah in the second paragraph is Rabbi Tarfon saying the day is short. We'll get there in a second. But remember, this section started, as we introduced, the five students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is the last of the five students. The Mishnah should end. Mishnah should end here. Why do we call Rabbi Tarfon? How does he get here? He's not one of the students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I don't know if you ever noticed that. Remember, we said at the beginning today, Pirkei Avot follows a very structured pattern. So, and we're discussing the students of Rabbi Tarfon doesn't belong. So why is he put here? So on the basic page, not in the commentary discussion, I looked in the back, the Melechet Shlomo, Rabbi Shlomo Adani raises that question. And he quotes that some people say Rabbi Tarfon was a student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. No, that's sort of a weakish answer. The mission then he wasn't listed as one of the students, but he says that what he thought is that he picks up on the theme of Rav Elazar. Rav Elazar said, I didn't focus on this so much, that Neman that your boss is going to give you a reward. And Rabbi Tarfon ends his teaching with the idea of reward. So the Mishnah just wanted to pick up on this idea of reward, and it's an interesting idea. They wanted to stress it even more that, it's okay to do mitzvot getting reward. We should do them lishma, but I wrote that yesterday. If anybody read the Daf Yomi piece I sent out last night about giving tzedakah for personal benefit. That seems to be what the Torah says we should give tzedakah. It says in the Torah, give tzedakah because there'll always be poor people. So one day your children are going to be near. That's how the Gemara says, black and white. That give tzedakah, so one day somebody, when you're in need, or your children, your grandchildren, since wealth is a galgala chozer b'olam, wealth is one generation yes, one generation no, wealth never continues indefinitely in a family, so you have to give charity. Or as the Gemara says, a person who says, I'm giving this charity so my children shall live, or I should get in the world to come, is a tzaddik amur. Not just a tzaddik, he's a totally righteous person. So it's interesting. So the rabbis were aware there's a place to say, because that's normal, that's what human beings are like. We want reward. We work, we want a reward. So the Mishnah added in Rabbi Tarfon because he talks about that God will give a reward, which is how Rabbi Elazar ended up. So I find that fascinating that the Mishnah is stressing this idea of getting a reward. And perhaps, like I say, that's why we start Pirkei Avot. It's not part of Pirkei Avot. It's Sanhedrin. Because Pirkei Avot is hard. In other words, to live up to the ideals in Pirkei Avot, to really learn Torah with such intensity, to be careful about the Shema and about how we pray and about how we interact with people. These are hard things to do. So they say, okay, we understand. You're all righteous. Let's go for it. So they want to strengthen us. So what does Rabbi Tarfon say? Quickly, Hayom Katsar, the day is short. We never have time to do everything. Even though we Hamalacham Merubat, the work, and Hayom doesn't just mean the day, means our life is short. Our life is short. And the work is great. There's so much to do. Polim Atzilim, and we're all lazy. We're all, but it's so beautiful. Hapolim Atzilim, we're lazy. We want to, you know, relax. It's okay a little bit to relax, but Hasachar Harbe, but the reward is great. Ubala Bay Dochek. And the master is knocking. That's God. Kol Dodi Dofek. That's Rav Soloveitchik's famous essay. The voice of my beloved, God is knocking. That's Rav Soloveitchik's famous manifesto on Zionism. God, the return to Zion is God's knocking to wake us up. But the Bala Bay Dochek here God is pushing us to do. There's so much to do, so little time, and we're so lazy. That's, of course, why another reason so important to join with a group, because other people motivate us. It's hard to be self-motivated. Well, if you want to be fully motivated, we need other people to help us. That's the other idea of Etzibur. Hu Haya Omer, the last Mishnah in the Perek, famous Lo Alecha Machaling Mor. I think anybody went to camp, you know, knows the song. I think Lo Alecha Machaling Mor. Okay, I won't sing anymore. But you're not free to exempt. So this is a very important point. You're not going to finish the work. That's okay. That's a famous story. Why do you plant trees? We plant trees even though my grandfather planted for me. I plant for my grandchildren. The idea is very often people don't want to start a project if they can't finish it. I remember when I was in yeshiva in Israel many years ago, when I was after high school, I read an article on Hanukkah time, Rabbi Hartman, David Hartman, the Hartman Institute, Rabbi in Montreal, also a great philosopher, Ashtik HaLafikoros, I think he would say about himself even, he had non-traditional beliefs in many ways, but anyway, that's for another time, but Rabbi Hartman wrote a beautiful article in the Jerusalem Post on Hanukkah, and he compared it to design it to Zionism. He said, what's the great miracle of Hanukkah? You know, the famous question, why is Hanukkah 8 days? There are only like 7 days of the miracle. They didn't have oil for 1 day. So he explains the great miracle was that they lit the oil on the first day. What was the purpose of lighting the oil? There wasn't going to be any oil tomorrow night. Why dedicate the temple now? Wait another month till they get everything. It's all dirty. It's not cleaned up. They don't have enough oil even for one more day. So it's stupid to start today, because that was the great miracle. The great miracle of Hanukkah is that they lit the menorah today. Tomorrow, we'll worry about tomorrow. We have to start. Well, we'll finish, we don't know. And then, of course, he compared it to Israel, Ben Gurion, and the declaration of the State of Israel, where the State Department urged, don't declare it. Wait till there's peace with the Arabs before we have a state. Yeah, we'd still be waiting. So sometimes you have to declare a thing. We don't know. And believe me, declaring the State of Israel was a tremendous, I wasn't alive then. That was a tremendous, tremendous act of faith. And it was a little bit of insanity, really, to declare a State of Israel, knowing what was coming next. But that I think, is a perfect example. Lo alecha macham limor. You're not going to finish. You're not going to get to the end. But you're not free to do what you can do now. Just start it. Other people will finish. Even lamadata Torah harbe. If you learned a lot of Torah, you get a great reward. This is the idea. This is why they're explaining. Continuing on, Rav Elazar, I roar. Your the b'malachtech is believed. It's the same language. He's believed that he will give you schar pulotecha v'tam matan scharan shel tzadikim l'atid lavo. But the great reward, the most of the reward, is in the world to come. We know that, and it has to be that way. If everybody got rewarded for what we did here and everybody got punished, it would take away our free choice. Because, if every time you ate non-kosher food, you got sick, you wouldn't eat non-kosher food. Every time you drove a car on Shabbos, you got into an accident, you wouldn't drive. So it has to be that way, that reward and punishment, sometimes you do, we don't see in this world. It will be in the next world. So that's how the second parak of Perkei Avot ends, the idea of getting reward. So just in 1 minute, that's very, very quick to review. I just want to mention Adin Steinsaltz, who accomplished so much and influenced so much Torah and the great work that he did. And then we discussed the idea of being careful in Shema and Tefillah, and the difference between Shema, affirmation of faith, and prayer. And prayer comes from the heart, and is prayer an actual obligation, and maybe only in a time of need, and how prayer should be spontaneous, but we need to sit here, otherwise we wouldn't know what to do, not looking down upon ourselves, viewing ourselves as good, being a Rasha, despite whatever the debate in Navordic and Slobodka was, being part of a community, stressing the idea of learning. You have to learn a lot, review a lot. You have to know enough to respond to an apikoros. We gave a few definitions. What exactly is an apikoros? We use the term very loosely. We have to focus. We have to ask the right questions. And then, of course, the idea that God gives a reward, and we have to do what we have to do. Okay, it's 10:30, so I'll wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for joining us. I missed you last week, but I had a good reason for not being here last week. So we should have many happy occasions to celebrate.